Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peep State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peep State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for October 10th, 2013. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my other two partners in crime, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing good, guys.
Yeah, doing great on this end, too.
And we have a new sponsor for the show. We are now sponsored by the Jerry Oates and McGuire Twins Fan Club. Bobby Simmons is the interim president until they can elect true officer.
He's the permanent president.
Speaking of which, I saw somebody post, I don't remember where I saw it, if it was on a wrestling message board or if it was on Facebook, but somebody posted up a breakdown of a one-night tournament that took place in Kansas City. And, I know what it was. It was somebody had put some magazines on eBay, and that was one of the stories in the magazine. That's where I saw it. And the semifinal was Jerry and Ted Oates against Rock Hunter and the Assassin, which was Jody Hamilton. They got by them, and then they worked in the main event. They worked with Ernie Ladd and Bruiser Brody, and you guys put them over.
Yeah, I remember.
What was that like, working with those two monsters?
That was a heck of a day then.
But you know, no knock on your brother Ted, but if you'd have had Benny and Billy in there with you, you wouldn't have lost that match.
Oh, listen. Everybody and his brother was there that day. Murdoch and Rhodes, the Bruiser, who else? One of the Funks, I don't know who my partner was, it was loaded. But it was, yeah, that was the only time I ever wrestled in Kansas City, Missouri. Because we always wrestled in Kansas City, Kansas, across the river.
Oh, did Geigel have to dust off some of the money he had stowed away to pay all that talent?
I tell you what, we gave him that piece of cash.
Was that a Christmas tournament?
I didn't even notice it.
It was in the wintertime because I had, that was a heck of a week. I had done a lot of TV that Saturday before, and I was in Detroit Saturday night, and then Sunday I was in, that tournament started in Kansas City at 3 o'clock, so I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get to Kansas City, and had to, I don't know if y'all ever been to Detroit, but that airport's a long way out, and I had to catch a shuttle bus to go out to the airport, and then I went from Detroit to Chicago, and then from Chicago to Kansas City. And when I got to Chicago that morning, it was 4 below 0.
Gee.
Was Ted already there? Was he already in the territory?
No, we were back in Columbus.
Okay.
And Greg Brown and Thomas Ivey, Saturday after TV in Atlanta, they just went with Ted, you know, they'd never been out there. So they left Atlanta and went to Kansas City. And I didn't meet up with them until about, I don't know, 1 o'clock when I got there.
Mm.
Yeah, I remember that. I think I told y'all that story. We're getting a ring with Brody and Martin. And Brody looked at me and he said, I don't work with midgets. Talking about Ted. He wasn't laughing.
Whoa.
He wasn't laughing. Ted said, what's this? And I said, don't worry about it, man. Don't worry about it. But we had a good match with him. Because you had with Brody. Of course, Ernie could work.
I was fixing to say, Ernie Ladd, people fussed at him because he was too light. I mean, you wouldn't know he was there. Had them hands the size of a baseball mitt, and you'd shake hands with him, man. He was like touching a sponge.
He was something. He was something else. Well, Jerry, you weren't with us last week, and I had the displeasure of having to announce the loss of one of our brethren. I'm not sure it's somebody that you worked with in the Carolinas, if not in Florida, Gene Lewis.
Yeah, I knew Gene. I saw that later on Facebook. What happened to him, Mike?
I don't know. I never have heard the cause of death, his age, or anything else. Johnny Mantell is how I found it. He posted it on Facebook. That's how I found out about it.
Was he from Mississippi?
Yes, he was from Jackson, Mississippi.
I thought he was from Mississippi. You knew him, didn't you, Bobby?
Yeah, I met him. He passed through here a couple times.
Yeah, that I had met him here, and I had run across him several other places, but I couldn't tell you where. He couldn't have been that old.
No, well, he started probably around the same time you did.
Did he really?
You know, he started. Yeah, he was maybe a year or two later than you, but he started in Florida. He was at he went to the University of Tampa. He played football along with Paul Orndorff. And he met up, somehow or another, he got met up with Dale Lewis, and they became big buddies, and he traveled with him and everything, and Dale trained him and got him into the business. And, of course, he broke in as Gene Lewis, Dale's brother. He worked under a dozen different names later on in his career, but he was in Florida as Dale Lewis. It's Gene Lewis. They went to Oklahoma together. And then Gene came into Mobile in 74, late 74, early 75, something like that, with Bruiser Sweetan. And then he came back in 76 and worked a while in Mobile. And then I don't know where he went. I think he went to the Carolinas from there and was in the Carolinas for at least a couple of years.
But, he was always a nice guy.
I've heard about him. He was a nice guy. He was a great worker. Could work with anybody, work any kind of style. So, when I sent the email out yesterday as far as the subject of what we were going to do tonight, I kind of left it as an open forum. But since then, I thought we'd do something a little different. I made a list of names, and hopefully these are all people who worked in Georgia one time or another, and hopefully you guys either worked in the ring with them, traveled with them, had the opportunity to see them work or something. I just thought I'd throw the names out there and let you guys just kind of give us a little story on them or whatever you remember best about them. But before we get started on them, I'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get started with the first name on our list. So let's take a quick break and pay some bills real quick.
That'll work.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbyszko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
We are back, and like I said, we're going to do a little name association here. Thought that would be interesting, so I'm going to throw the first name out. We'll start with you, on each, Jerry, on each one of these. Get your opinion, and Bobby will do you. We're going in age order. Jerry's the oldest, so we'll let him go first.
Thank you, sir.
And I promise, the McGuire twins are not on this list. If you so desire to talk about them, we'll be glad to go off script here and we'll talk about them on you.
They've made me famous here in the last month or so.
Well, the first name on my list is Paul Orndorff. Did you ever work with Paul?
No. No. I was around Paul. I wasn't around Paul that much. I know when I left Oregon and come back through, worked my way back across the United States, he was out there for Watts then, and I was with him about three nights. And I wasn't really around him that much here in Georgia.
Yeah, because he was in Georgia in 82, I guess. Bobby, that was about just before you left the business. Were you around him much? Or?
I was around him a lot. He was here a lot longer. He was here a lot earlier than that, too.
Was he?
He was here in 70. All these years run together, Mike, so I'm going to get the year wrong. He was here 75, maybe 76. Yeah, right. He was just starting. He was working opening matches. A couple of matches up the card. He was just learning how to work. Traveled by himself a lot. Paul had a desire to learn this business inside out, and he worked hard at it. He, you know, always on time, always did what you ask, you know. Nice guy. I refereed a lot of his matches when he was here the first time. He was in here. I mean, at one time we had him, we had Scott Irwin, we had Ricky Steamboat, we had Tito Santana, we had, you know, I mean, all these guys were in here about the same time. Yeah.
I saw him, well, I worked a couple of television cards for him just before I got out of the business in 82, and that's when he was hitting his stride in Georgia, and working on top of that. He had worked in Mobile for Fuller. We crossed paths a little bit there. I was just a fan then, just learning, trying to break into the business when he was in Mobile. I think other than his big national run working for Vince, I think he's most associated with the Mid-South area, Watts' area. And he had some tremendous matches with DiBiase and with the Junkyard Dog, and he was one of those that could work either way. It was fantastic as a babyface, which he was in Georgia, and just as good as a heel, which he did both in Louisiana working for Watts. But I thought he was a great worker. He was a seemed like a nice guy and everything. A few times I was around him, but Bobby. He worked hard.
He had a real desire to learn this business inside out, as far as the working was concerned. He wanted to be the best he could be, and I mean he worked hard. Whether he was on the opening match or like I say, I wasn't around him that much after he got to where he was working on top a lot, but when he was just he worked as hard, if not harder, than anybody around when he was first getting started.
And he was a tough son of a gun too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was.
You know about the deal with him and Leon White in Atlanta, don't you?
Well, I've heard bits and pieces. I've never heard the whole story.
Well, I think Paul, his arm shriveled on him. He got some nerve damage.
Yeah.
You knew about that. So, anyway, I'll make a long story short. He was working with, what was it called, WCW, whatever they call it. He was a TV there. They told him that they needed Leon to get ready for some interviews, and Paul went down and told him, and still didn't come up. One thing led to another. Well, he beat him up twice in one day. They said he wore the big man out. Big man told him he'd be up there when he got ready or something, said something, to Paul, and he didn't sit right with Paul, so he just went ahead and worked him over.
Jeez.
Yeah, he wasn't nobody to play with now.
Mm. Yeah, he
was one of the nice guys.
And of course, he more recently, he's had that battle with cancer and seems to have beaten it, I should say. My Alabama's coming out. From the pictures I've seen of him lately, he really looks like he's doing well. So,
where's he living?
All right. As far as I know, he's still living in Carrollton.
Where?
Carrollton, he was in Fayetteville.
Oh, Fayetteville, that's right. Fayetteville.
Yeah, he's down
Carrollton's where he owned a bowling alley.
Was it Carrollton or did he own it in Fayetteville?
I always heard Carrollton. It may have been Fayetteville.
Yeah. Rock Hunter lives in Carrollton somewhere out there, but
okay.
I think one girl's in Fayetteville.
Okay.
I think you're right, Bobby. I think you are right.
Yeah.
All right. The next name on our list, and he's more thought of as part of a tag team, but he was always the shining star of that tag team, in my opinion. He's the one with all the talent in that tag team. That's Terry Gordy.
Yeah, Terry was a good worker. He was a good worker.
Seemed like he was just a natural, like he was born for the business. And of course, he started so young. He was only 13 when he started, but he was just... It's like, he kind of reminded me of the second coming of Murdoch. He just every move he made sense, and it was the perfect move for what he was doing. And he wasn't one of those guys that went to the gym and worked out and all that stuff, but he was just a natural, raw-bone wrestler.
Yeah, he's a big old boy, and he had it going on. He was going to Japan. He was making money over there, and you just hated to see a guy that did well to do that to himself. I've always shook my head at that. I never understood it, and I guess I never will. But that wasn't my makeup or my, forte to do what a lot of guys did. But and died young, died real young.
Yeah. That's true.
I've got a tape somewhere, or I don't know where it's at. Gene Bennett gave it to me when Luthez was running, Kentucky, Tennessee, where he was running against Gulas. Had Terry Gordy working under a mask as Mr. Wrestling, the white mask, white boots, white trunks. And Gene told me he was 13 years old, working on TV.
He's probably a little boy then,
I mean, he was thin, but he was a lot thinner than what he got to be when he got a little older. But he was, I mean, you could just as smooth as glass.
Yep.
You know, he was, and I agree with you, Jerry. I never, my mindset, I can't understand. I mean, first of all, I guess, and I don't know if this is the case, but, you know, it's like these athletes that make all these mega bucks and this big money. You know, they get all this notoriety thrown on them and all this glory and this money, and they don't know how to handle it. They don't know what to do. So they think they have to maintain some sort of lifestyle or front or whatever it is. I mean, personally, you know, I never had that, but I never wanted anything, no matter what kind of euphoric high it would give me, where I lost control of myself or I couldn't control my surroundings. And
well, you know, going picking up a big paycheck is a high, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The guy, he had the world on a string. Here's another guy that had the world on a string, and he didn't know how to tie the knot in the end of it.
Bubba, you know, I think a lot of guys didn't take what we did for a living that serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a business. It's just like any other business. It was a business.
That's exactly
but
right.
But I don't know if they took it as serious as they should have, or... Well, you know, it's just we wrestle. We're wrestlers, you know, so that makes it okay to show up drunk or doped up or whatever. I've gotten in the ring with a lot of guys that shouldn't have been in the ring.
Yep. I mean, he's dead and gone now, but there's only one human being that I wanted to have a drink in him when I got in the ring because it calmed him down, and that was Luke Graham. It mellowed Luke out, and I knew that, and everybody else did. So it was never a big deal if you know when you knew he had had.
No, it wasn't.
I never saw him drunk. You know, not in the ring. But it was just, yeah. I'm like you. I've been in a ring with guys that you could look in their eyes and tell there wasn't nobody home.
You're correct.
Not calling any names, Buzz Sawyer, but
oh jeez.
You were talking about Luke Graham. I think Lonnie Main was a lot the same way. You know, he was a better worker when he had a little snort in him. He was just looser and an all around better worker. And I've heard that from a lot of different people about working with Moondog.
He's one of the funniest people I've ever been around. I know that.
He was crazy.
I've had the privilege to get to know his brother a little bit, Shane. I met him at Dean Silverstone's a few years ago when I went out there with Charlie Smith to a reunion, and he comes to Vegas every year, and we always get together and talk. But yeah, Lonnie was I know I've told this before, but we left Columbus TV one Saturday, and between Columbus TV and Carrollton, he got absolutely wasted. I mean, he was plastered, and he's working with Slater in the main event in Carrollton, and we were closing for Christmas. We were off 3 or 4 days for Christmas, and he climbed up on that top rope and stood straight up, and he fell like a tree backwards. He never bent his knees. He just went over backwards from the top rope to the floor. And I looked down at Slater. Slater looked at me and said, "He's dead." And I was afraid to go look, and I walked over there, and he was laying on the floor laughing. And he looked up at me just as sincere, and he says, "Please count me out." Not a problem. But, you know, I want to say Slater told the story about coming into Las Vegas or back from Las Vegas, back into California, and he got snookered and climbed out on top of the roof of the car and it running about 80 miles an hour. Just crazy.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, I me neither.
Okay, the next name on our list, Bob Orton Jr. Did you have work
with him? There was a guy that could work. He was a good worker.
Dude, he could do anything. Ask him to do
that too.
He could do whatever he wanted to.
Did you ever work with him, Jerry? Wrestling in the
ring? Oh, yeah.
What was he like wrestling with him?
You know, for a guy that never, evidently, he never went to a gym, but that was one of the strongest jokers. I mean, Bob was just that, I don't know, he was just naturally strong. He could pick anybody up and do anything he wanted to with them. But he was very good.
He was deceptively big. You look at pictures of him and everything, you wouldn't think he was that big, but he was not a small guy. He was thin.
No, he was not small.
But he's good 6'3", 6'4", and probably pushed 230, 240 at his peak. And was from watching him work, I never wrestled him, but watching him work, he was smooth and chill.
Yeah, everything he did looked good. He's one of those guys that didn't waste anything, you know. When he did it, he did it with perfection, you know. Very strong guy.
Jerry, did you ever work with Senior?
Yes, I did.
Did you?
Work with him. You remember when he was here as a Zodiac, Bobby?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Oh. Yeah,
I've heard it was like night and day between the two of them.
There was no comparison.
Who was stiffer?
He was on
Big O or
he was
Valentine?
He was almost Johann Smith. Y'all laugh. That ain't what no joke, guys.
I met Orton Senior, but I never was in a ring with him. But Junior was always fun to work with. Especially when you get excited and try to talk to you. But when Gary Hart came up with the idea to put him and Slater together as a tag team, what a team they were.
Yes, they were.
And worked. The first time I ever met Randy Rose, I was walking down through the sports arena there, and I heard somebody grunting. Not a grunt sort of in pain grunt, like, and I walked up in the arena, and there was some furniture pads spread out on the floor, and all I could see of Randy was his butt and his feet, and Orton Jr. had him, and Orton was kind of in a relaxed mode because he had him tied up with his leg some way, and he said, hey, Bobby, he said, this is Randy, Randy Alls at the time, he said, Randy, say hello to Bobby, and Randy said, ooh. I just turned around, went on out. Yeah, Bob used to come to the Monday workout sessions over at the arena when I first started over there. So
you just carried on with what you were doing, right?
Yeah, I didn't, you know. Listen, I may have told you this. I don't know. I guess the scaredest I have ever been, the Monday that I came to work for Barnett, I had worked for Gunkel for 2 years. I walked in there, didn't know anybody over there. Barnett come out of the back office and took me to the back and introduced me to Harley, who was the booker at the time. And I'd heard all the horror stories, and I sat down with Harley, and Harley put me totally at ease. You know, Harley said, look, you're a young kid. He said, I realize you got a lot of, you know, you're just getting started. You know, you're coming over here, you don't know anybody. And then he shared with me how he used to drive Happy Humphrey around and things he did. He said, look, everybody goes through rough patches. He said, but I'm going to take care of you. You'll be all right. And I said, well, thank you. I appreciate it. So he told me I was going to Waycross that night. And he said, come on, let's go down to the arena and watch them work out. And me and him were sitting in a chair down there talking. And this is one of those deals where, you know, they were in the ring, and finally Harley got up, got in the ring, and he plastered some kid. I mean, just, it was awful. And I'll never forget, I was sitting there thinking, oh, my God, they're not going to ask me to work out, are they? So I got up, went back up top. It was pretty intimidating. But it was, it was interesting. But yeah, back to Orton Jr. What a, you know, just a good guy, and he worked hard, and he did everything anybody ever asked him, and I'm glad he had some success in this business. He was always fun to be around.
Did you get to spend any time with him in Mobile this past March, Bobby?
Not a lot, there. No. I talked to him a little bit when we were in Vegas last year. Matter of fact, I've got a picture of me and him and Jerry Briscoe together. I think that was 2 years ago, but he's funny. He said, I used to be Bob's son. He said, now I'm Randy's dad. He said, I've never quite developed my own personality.
Well, his role always seemed to be, no matter what territory he worked in, he was a henchman of some sort. Especially when, you know, he went to New York for Vince. He was Roddy Piper's sidekick for so long, and that's the way most people remember him, and that's a shame, those who didn't get to see him work. And you're right, that team of he and Slater, and then later on, Bob and Don Kernodle were a great team in the Carolinas.
Well, you know, I think one of the things I think that kept him from emerging more than what he did was the fact that he stuttered, and he couldn't do interviews.
Right.
And I think that held him back a lot. If he had been able to have talked, he would have probably, I think, more so a heel than a babyface. I think he'd have been one of the top heels in our business.
Could have been. Well, speaking of somebody who can talk, the next name on my list is the American Dream himself, Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah, what can you say? what can
still
you say?
Still at it. Still on TV, still drawing people to the arenas. They've got him in this angle in New York, evidently, with his two kids, Dustin and Cody, and he's still... I tell you, and I've said this on this show before, but after he turned... I saw him not long after he turned babyface in Florida in 1974, and in Tampa at that hot, sweaty Fort Heslie Arena, and it was jam-packed, people standing room only, standing along the walls up on the second floor, and I thought the Beatles were there, the way they reacted to him. I've never heard such a pop in all my life as I heard when Dusty would come out, because, you know, the baby faces. Did you ever work in that building, Bobby? I know, Jerry, I know you did.
No, never did.
The baby face dressing room was up on the... They didn't really have a second floor. They had a mezzanine that wrapped three-quarters of the way around the building where, you know, there was a balcony, more or less, and that's where people would stand up alongside the wall, and they sold standing-room-only tickets. That's where they did. They went up along that second floor and literally stood with their backs to the wall. Well,
you know, it's the one that's a building that gave in.
You know, that's true. You know, there's
many
still,
people
that
say, building, my God.
Yep, and stomp their feet, and the whole building would shake. But the baby face dressing room at the one, it was at one end, and there was a little hallway that came out, and then at the end of that hallway, there was a little overhang where it was about 3 feet wide and came out about, what, 2 or 3 feet, Jerry? And there was rails
something
around
like that,
it. And Dusty would come out there, and he'd stand there. And, you know, he's always chewing gum. And the people would just, they would stomp and clap, and he would raise one arm, and you'd think the roof was going to come off of that place. And he'd raise the other arm, and you'd think the walls were going to cave in. That's how popular he was back in the day.
Oh, he was over.
I don't think anybody in this business has ever been as over, and that includes Hulk Hogan. As popular as he was at his peak, I think Dusty was more so. Maybe not as nationwide because he wasn't on national television, but I guarantee you every swinging soul in the state of Florida from Jacksonville South knew who Dusty Rhodes was, whether they were a wrestling fan or not.
They knew who he was. He was just electricity with him.
Between that and the stand back commercials and the Tom Stymus commercials and everything else he did, he was pretty well over in Georgia as well.
Well, he came in here. They brought him in here I wasn't working there. This is speculation. They came in here. He was the white answer to Thunderbolt Patterson. You know, Thunderbolt was working for us, and he was getting on TV talking to Jive, and you know, people were going crazy over that. And then Dusty shows up talking to Jive, and the buzz was, here's a white man talking like this, and people went crazy, and he got over here too.
He sure did. He flat did.
I remember a deal they did in Atlanta. I can't remember who he was working with. It might have been Ole. They had worked some program, and Ole or Dusty got suspended. And the deal was that Dusty came back under a hood as Uvalde Slim.
Mm-hmm.
And then they worked the deal where they said, okay, Uvalde Slim and Dusty have to appear together, or the suspension is going to be permanent, and Uvalde Slim will have to unmask. So the dang Omni was sold out. It was one of those things we were running. We still had the auditorium, so we wasn't running the Omni just maybe once a month. And we did the deal and brought Randy Colley in as Uvalde Slim. And he went to the ring that night. And God love him, there's another guy. He could do anything you ask him to do. He looked more like Dusty than Dusty did when he got in there working with Ole.
And looked more like Jody than Jody did.
But yeah, him and Roger Smith both. They finally said, you know, well, wait a minute, Dusty's supposed to be. And when he, same kind of deal, he come out of that dressing room, and you know, in the Omni they use spotlights, and they hit him with that spotlight when he come out of that dressing room, and son, that place came unglued. And then after the fanfare was over, then people said, well, who is this under this hood? And we never, you know, nobody ever told them. I mean, we never, that was the end of the deal. But, I mean, Randy pulled it off wonderfully.
Mm. Now, were you there the night that Dusty beat Harley in the Omni for the second title?
Yeah, if you watch the tape of that, I'm sitting at the table there with Charlie McGowan and Freddie Miller. I was a mark that night. In all my years in the business, I had never seen that NWA title change hands, so I took my butt out there and sat at the table.
Well, that was, I did TV at TBS the day before that, and that was the day I dropped that note in Harley's bag asking him to come work in Fayette, Alabama for the grand total of $50. And I signed that promoter's name to it.
I love it.
I don't know. I got out of there. I didn't wait for Harley's reaction, so I don't know if it got over or not. All right. Another great talker, but in a different manner. This guy is in the Bill Eady, Jody Hamilton, Tom Ernesto school of promos. That's Buddy Colt. Buddy Colt is a young man, like Bobby used to say about Sputnik Monroe, Buddy Colt scared me when I was a young man. He was so calm, well, I thought he was an axe murderer, serial killer or something. He was just that, seemed that blood curdling to me.
He was really over here. He looked the part, he could talk. Yeah, he was, and I liked Buddy. Buddy was a good guy.
Yeah.
You think he was old? I don't know if you, did you ever see him in Florida, Jerry?
You mean after he left here?
It was in Georgia. Yeah, it was in Georgia or in Florida. Well, he was back and forth there for a while, especially during the split, because he had points in both offices at one point. And so he split his time between Florida and Georgia, but I saw him in Tampa, and that's where he just, you know, it was like the parting of the Red Seas when he came out of the dressing room. Nobody dared mess with him at all. He was just that his persona was just that scary, almost as much as Valentine. Or that girl, just he just looked like he could hurt you.
He was a big river too.
Was he?
Yeah, him and Spears.
You gonna make me tell a story I don't can't tell on the air about Spears?
I'll tell you, a rib got pulled on them one night and got. I mean, it was serious.
On Billy.
On Buddy. We're talking, as Ernesto used to say, white heat. Savannah. Buddy was there was a young lady here in Atlanta that had a crush on him. And of course,
that's
Buddy,
right.
Buddy was married, and you know, we were in Savannah, Buddy comes in the dressing room, and Rocket came in a little late, and Rocket goes, "Man," he said, "I didn't think I was ever going to get away from them cops." And Buddy goes, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Man," he said, "there was some cops pulled up at my apartment, and they was questioning me, and they wouldn't let me go." And Buddy said, "What's the matter? What's the deal?" He said, "Well," he said, "I don't know how to tell you this." He said, "It was about you." And he said, "What do you mean it's about me?" He said, "Well," he said, "some girl in Atlanta committed suicide."
Oh, my God.
And said she left a note that the reason she killed herself was that you had promised to leave your wife and marry her, and you just wasn't going to do it. And I mean, he was naming names and places. I mean, he had done his homework, because, you know, Rocket was a river too. And so, listen, I thought there was going to be a bloodletting. I mean, I thought he was going to die right there in that chair. And Rocket sold the thing so good that they believed it for it. And he didn't let him off the hook till almost time for him to go in the ring.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was strong. So, you know.
He may have had a little bit of extra reason for being a little paranoid on that. If this happened before, I guess sometime in the late 60s, Colt and Gorgeous George Jr. were both working in Texas. And they went over to into Mexico and got George got locked up. And when they asked him his name, he told them his name was Buddy Colt.
Would you ever hear Jack Donovan tell a story when him and Buddy were partners in Oklahoma, that they stopped on the side of the road for Jack to use the bathroom? And when Jack got up in the woods, I mean, well, you know, the one time he got up there, he went up there and got in the middle of a drug deal. But they said this time he got up in the woods and Buddy drove off and left him. And he said he had to catch a ride on the back of a chicken truck to the... This is when he was married. He was married to Vern Bottoms. Is
Vern
that the
Bottoms,
right name?
Yeah, Vern Bottoms.
He was supposed to meet Vern at the hotel there, wherever they were going. And when they got there, Buddy told Vern, said, "Well, I don't know. He said he was going to catch a ride with somebody else. He didn't ride with me." And Jack had to ride on the back of a chicken truck.
I remember seeing Colt here as Ron Reed. That's when I first saw him.
That's, yeah.
Right. He was Cowboy Ron Reed.
I say as a,
exactly.
As a kid, I went to the matches. Yeah, he was here about the same time Dennis Hall and Les Thatcher came in, and Roger Kirby were here the first time.
Yeah, the cousins, yeah.
That was like, was that 64, 65, Bobby?
Yeah,
somewhere
yeah,
in there?
In that time frame, sure was. Maybe 66.
I remember
in that era,
school.
Yeah.
He worked a handful of matches before he was Cowboy Ron Reed. He was just plain Ron Reed. He was a few months into the business, and the person he worked with was a guy by the name of Pretty Boy Calhoun. You guys have any idea who that was?
I have no idea.
We just talked about him a few minutes ago. Luke Graham. That was before he was Luke Graham.
Really?
He was the name Pretty Boy Calhoun.
Huh.
And their match was so bad in Mobile that they had to send guys out to break it up. I guess Grady hadn't had any drink that night or something.
Where was Colt from originally?
Washington. Well, he was billed as being from New York City, but he was from Washington, D.C. Baltimore, actually, is where he was born and raised.
Is that right? I didn't know where he was from.
Yep, he was from Baltimore. But I don't know which time he was in Georgia, but he got arrested in Phoenix City one time, too. And he skipped court and never went back to Phoenix City.
Jeez.
All right, well, I'm going to tell a story about Billy Spears. Roberto Soto told me this, and I'm not sure if Soto, I think it was Soto that pulled the rib. They were, I don't know what town they were in, but they were in the dressing room, and Spears was about to get in the shower or had just come out of the shower. Either way, he was, you know, as naked as the day he was born. And Soto ran in, or whoever it was, ran in and slammed the door closed and said, "Quick, lock up all the doors, close all the windows. It's gotten away. You know, the guy's about to get away," and everybody's looking at him and said, "Well, what are you talking about?" He said, "Somebody stole Billy's penis."
You know, that wasn't Soto. You know who that was, Michael?
Who was it?
It was Ed Caprell. That happened at the TV station in Atlanta.
Soto's the one that told me the story.
Caprell walked in the dressing room, slammed the door, and said, "Nobody move. Nobody goes. Somebody has stole." Yeah, that's Charlie Smith. Charlie Smith told me that story. He said Caprell did that.
And evidently, somewhere along the line, he felt bad about it. He bought one of those penis pumps.
Uh-huh.
And his wife caught him with it.
His wife,
that,
yeah, that's
boys,
a true story, yeah.
All the boys called him Stretch from then on.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, I got that.
You're talking about Luke Graham. Jerry, did you ever meet Dick Barker?
Oh, please.
Do what?
Yes, sir.
You know Dick? Dick was Dick and Luke Graham were best friends. Luke got Dick into the business. And Luke Barkley told me the story. When I first met Barkley, I wouldn't give you 15 cents for him because it was just, you know, he didn't come across real good with me. But anyway, as he got a little older, I kind of got to where I tolerated him. But Luke told the story to back up what Dick told me. He took Barkley, and Barkley had no idea anything about the business, nothing. He put Barkley in the building, put him in a seat. He said, "I'm going to wrestle." He said, if I need help or I need you to come to the ring, he said, "You come down there, okay?" And, of course, Barkley said, "Well, I got you back, okay, you know." So they were somewhere, and I don't remember where they were, but he said, Luke said, he motioned for Barkley to come down to the ring. And he said, Barkley walked down there, and he said, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. He just was walking down there because Luke called him. He said, when he got down there, Luke run his hand down in his pocket. He said, and he knew he didn't have nothing in his pocket. He said, but Luke run his hand in there, and he said he come out with that fist, and he hit the guy he was working with, and the guy went down out cold, and Luke covered him, 1, 2, 3. And Barkley said, "I didn't have a clue why I was fighting." He said, "But I had to fight for my life to get out of the building." That was his introduction to the wrestling business.
Barkley was something else.
Yes, he was.
Did you ever see his picture collection?
No, never did.
Oh, come on, man. That man had pictures, I'm talking about photographed pictures, of every movie star. You name them, and he had them.
Huh.
There's no telling what that collection was worth.
Hmm.
I have never seen anything like it in my life.
I wonder what happened to him.
I have no idea. I guess his son got him. There's no telling what that collection.
Barkley, I run into him and Luke at a Poe Folks restaurant. I went in to eat, and they come in while I was sitting there, and I walked over and spoke to them. They were working some kind of antiques flea market thing together.
He was something else, Barkley was.
Did you ever see him work?
Long time ago, when I was 13, 14 years old, probably.
I never saw him work. I didn't even know who he was when I met him.
He was a sheriff down in
Thomasville.
Uh, That's exactly where it was.
Yeah, because that's where I met him. He promoted for Ann. He ran Thomasville. We ran at the high school down there, and that's where I met him at.
He was a sheriff down there. That's the fact. That's exactly where it was.
Yep.
All right. Next name
on our
list.
That name was on your list, was it, Michael?
No.
Oh, okay.
But that's good. I've never heard of him. Did he only work in Georgia evidently? Must not have traveled anywhere.
He worked a little bit in Florida, you know. He was a different kind of guy. I mean, I liked him, you know. He was always nice to me, and he lived there in Macon at the end.
But that, going back to what Bobby said, that trick that Luke Graham pulled on him, Jerry Graham pulled that on somebody in the 50s in Mobile. Some hitchhiker he picked up or whatever. It happened at Ladd Stadium, if I'm not mistaken. He had the guy go out and be his valet. You know, he told the guy to give him a few bucks or whatever. And it happened to be a black guy. And of course, this is 1950s Alabama, so you can imagine what that was like. And so he had this guy go out and carry his, you know, handed him his cape and all that stuff. And of course, the crowd's already ready to kill this guy, and he did the same thing. He rolled in the heat of the battle. He rolled out of the ring and called the guy over to him and reached at him and pulled something out, you know, an invisible object. Got in the ring and knocked whoever it was out, Mario Galanto or Lee Pitt or whoever. And if I'm not mistaken, he went back dressed and left the guy out there. I don't even think he cared. I don't think he ever saw him again.
God.
Could be that guy's family never saw him again, too. So. But the next name on my list was Bobby Shane. And I know he was probably before your time, Bobby, or the last time, I guess, he worked in Georgia. He may have been working for Ann. But he was in and out of Georgia about the same as Buddy Colt was. He was working to spread his time between Mobile, Florida, and Georgia. I don't know if you ever got to work around him or be around him. Jerry, I don't know if you ever did either.
Yeah, I worked with him.
How good was it?
He wasn't the smoothest guy I ever worked with.
Jerry's trying to be polite. Everybody I've ever talked to that ever worked with him said he was horrible.
I didn't want to go that far, Bobby.
I know he had a head. I know you didn't, and I never worked with him and never met him. But that he had a great persona, did a great interview. You know, he was the consummate heel on the microphone and the way he carried himself. But as far as getting in the ring and working, everybody I've ever talked to and ever worked with him said he was hard to work with.
He was stiff. I'll never forget this, and I can't remember the four of us. It was me and Bobo Brazil against Shane and somebody else in Atlanta, Georgia. I can't remember who his partner was. They left the ring. This guy tried to take a poke at Shane or whatever. The cops grabbed the guy and handcuffed him. And when they handcuffed the guy, Shane nailed him. Oh, my God. Those cops went berserk. They went absolutely berserk. I mean, it looked like, don't hit this guy till we get him in handcuffs, right? It was awful. And you know, I don't know if Bobby, he was getting one heck of a push when he, you know, went to Florida. I don't know if he had that good a head on him. As far as like maybe going to be a booker somewhere or had great ideas, but no, his work, no. It may look good sitting in the ring tonight, but not in there with him. It was almost a struggle.
Yeah.
Well, of course, when I saw him work in Mobile, I was just a kid, so I didn't know the difference in a good worker and a bad worker, but I know one thing, he was a heat magnet in Mobile. Of course, they worked that whole thing with he and Lee Field where Lee came out of retirement. And they worked that thing for almost a year.
and only had three matches. They were they ran that program for nearly the entire year of 1971, and only had three matches. And
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And I know I've told this story before, but Shane, one of the last appearances he made that year, he was booked for a special. You know, Lee always had these big festivals at different time of holidays and stuff during the year, and he had a Christmas holiday festival booked. And the day before, Shane said he wanted 10% of the gate, or he wasn't coming. He called from Tampa. So, at least, you know, he browbeat Lee, and Lee finally agreed to it. Then he announced that all the tickets on the seat were $1. So he'd have been better off just getting whatever his normal draw was.
You know, see, when a guy does that, I got no respect for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I really don't.
He came back for one shot after. Of course, he went to Australia for nearly a year and was booking there for Barnett. And then he came back in December of 74. He made one appearance in Dothan in, it was either Dothan or Mobile in January of 75. And then, of course, the plane crash was in February of 75. But he was definitely... He was the heel version of Dusty. He could work, talk people into their seats to come see him get beaten. But again, that when I saw him as a kid, you know, I didn't know the difference between a good worker and a bad worker. I just knew he was a heat magnet. But the next person on our list, there's no doubt he was a good worker. I mean, I don't know whether either one of you guys ever worked with him, Nelson Roy.
He was, oh, what a worker Nelson was. Nelson was something else. Wasn't the biggest man in the world, but good Lord.
No, he was
a nice guy. He was Nelson.
Yes, he was.
He was a sweetheart. He was a super nice man.
Never was in the ring with him, but and I didn't meet him until he came to Mobile. But he talked to me like he had known me my whole life.
That's the way he was, Bobby.
Super guy.
Never met a stranger.
Yeah.
Oh, he was. He was just, oh, man, what a nice man.
You know, when he was the junior heavyweight champion, most of the time he worked heel, at least the times I saw him. And I say worked heel. He was the only person I ever saw have people hating him and never broke a rule. He would out-wrestle somebody and the fans would hate him.
Yeah, exactly. I know when I was in Louisiana, he was the junior heavyweight champion. He was out there. He was just such a pleasure to be around.
And like you said,
he owned
nice
a
guy.
Western store up in Carolina somewhere.
Yep. And was in North Carolina. Can't think of what the name of the little town was. It's where he was living when
was
he died.
Was it Mooresville or something like that?
Mooresville, North Carolina.
I think that was where it was. Oh, he was a nice guy, man. Oh, my goodness.
You know, when he first broke into business, he broke in and, or well, at least when he first got noticed and everything, he was working in Texas as Sir Nelson Royal, and he was an English heel.
Really?
Huh.
Yeah. He even went in the first time he ever worked in the Carolinas. He worked as Sir Nelson Royal was an English heel, and he I can't remember who he was teaming with, the Viking or somebody, and then they had a split, and then he decided he wanted to be an American, so he started wearing cowboy gear and speaking like an American. So and the fans bought it, I guess. All right. Next person on our list is also mainly known in the Carolinas, but did work in quite a bit in Georgia. I think he worked for Ann during the split. That's Tommy Ziegler.
Yeah. Anderson, South Carolina.
Yep. I will say this.
Yeah, Bobby.
Had Ted Oates not gotten into the wrestling business, Jerry Oates and Tommy Ziegler would have made a tremendous tag team. Tommy's always reminded me of you for some reason.
Bobby was around him more than I was. I worked with him up in Clemson, South Carolina one night. Other than that, I was really never around.
Tommy was a nice guy. He good-looking kid, came in here, and he was a great baby face for Ann. He was here almost the whole 2 years. May have been here the whole 2 years. He wound up marrying a friend of Ann. I can't remember his name. The friend of Ann's was head of the Republican Party in the state of Georgia at the time, and he had a daughter, and Tommy and her got together, and he wound up marrying her. I think they had several kids together. But Tommy, when he got out of the business, when he left Ann, he got out of the business. He's a park police or something. Anyway, he worked for the city of Anderson there in South Carolina. That's where he's at. That's where he still lives. And I guess he retired from that. He comes to Mobile every year now. Matter of fact, that's the son that he has with him. It's his oldest son, I think. He's probably a product of that marriage. But Tommy was a great guy. He's the guy that was in the ring with Jody that night. The guy jumped in the ring in the cage.
Did he ever work anywhere else, Bobby?
He worked in Florida, I know. And I'm sure he did. He started in the Carolinas, didn't he, Michael? Didn't he start for Crockett?
Yeah, he started in the Carolinas, and then they sent him to Mobile. He worked a couple weeks in Mobile, and then went on to Florida, and I think he would was he with the NWA office when the split happened? I think he was.
Yes, he came in. He had come in here. He was working here, and then when the split came, he went with Ann.
And of course, he went back to the Carolinas, and that's where he was best known, was in the Carolinas. I'm surprised that one match is the only time you were ever around him, Jerry, as much as you were in and out of the Carolinas, because that was where he was.
I never saw him when I was up there.
When
we were up there.
That territory was so big, they probably had him in a different set of towns than you and Ted were in.
Oh, yeah, you could go a while and not see guys.
So
he ran three towns a night up there.
I know it.
It was something else.
All right. The next name on our list here, you missed him just a minute ago, Bobo Brazil.
There's a man that he was. I don't know if he was around me much, Bobby, but he was one of the funniest guys that I've ever been around. And nice. And Bobo, I'll tell you how smart Bobo was. He played the game. He caused no trouble. He never gave any. I've never heard of him ever giving any promotion or Booker any trouble. You know, he knew his place. He knew his role. And he played it. And Bobo was happy.
Took the money to the bank. I've never heard one person say one bad thing about him.
Well, if anybody ever says anything bad about him, it's a lie, isn't it, Bobby?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, it is. I came in, he would come in here. He would come in for a week or two stretch, or sometimes we'd fly him in for the Omni. But when he was here for a week or two, he always wanted me and John Walker to ride with him because he wanted me to drive. And him and John could talk, and I'd, you know, try to learn. But it was always fun for me because it wasn't often I got to drive big El Dorado, you know. So we'd tool around for a couple of weeks if we were in the same towns. But super nice guy.
Not a nicer man that ever put on a pair of boots.
No.
I'm like you. I never heard anybody say one bad word about him ever.
No,
matter where you went. Ever.
And everything I've heard about
him. He's a big man, man.
For him to get along with the Sheik as many years as he did, he had to be a nice guy.
He played the game.
Yep.
Like you said.
Bobo wouldn't have stayed there. I mean, he could have went anywhere he wanted to have stayed.
He could have gone anywhere he wanted. but that was close to home because he was, you know, lived in Benton Harbor, and which is fairly close to Detroit, I guess, in Michigan. But he was close to home and didn't have to travel much. But I never met the man, never had that opportunity. But from everybody I've talked to, was the way he carried himself was similar to Luthez and Danny Hodge. He was always immaculate, dressed well,
oh, please,
as far as the way he dressed and everything, and just was what our business was about, the type of person he was.
When I was with him, I could not pay for anything. He would always say, he'd say, "Kid, I probably made a little more than you did this week." And whether it was a Coca-Cola, whether it was a Coca-Cola or we were stopping to eat or whatever, never would let me pay a dime. I mean, just never. And you talk about being immaculate. His clothes cost more than I made a week.
Bobby, and he was sincere when he would say stuff. I mean, wasn't a cockiness anything like that. Bobo was,
I heard Jack Briscoe tell the story Bobo would go over to Japan, and he wouldn't be able to take enough snuff with him. So whenever Briscoe would go over there, he'd have to take Bobo his a certain brand of snuff that he liked. All right, to the other end of the spectrum, Mr. Unpredictable himself, Dick Slater.
Well, go ahead, Bobby.
He's a good worker. I mean, he could work when he wanted to.
If he didn't want to be Terry Funk, he would have been better.
Yeah.
That was the main knock on him, I think.
I
thought that was so ridiculous.
Yeah. But when he wanted to work, he could work. He worked hard when he wanted to. He was Georgia heavyweight champion several times. He had runs here as Top Heel. He had some great matches with wrestling too. They did all sorts of matches. I quit matches. Baby Bonnie matches, just all sorts of things. I personally enjoyed his work when he teamed with Orton Jr. and Gary Hart was managing him as well as anything I ever saw him do, because they were they just worked together well as a team. He had some trouble and some issues outside the ring. I mean, it's not a big secret now. Wahoo shot him one night. Coming out of a club over there, and Wahoo thought that he had watched too many detective shows on TV and thought he could hit the guy in the back of the head with a pistol and it'd knock him out, and all he did was discharge the gun and shoot Slater. But fortunately, it shot him in the fat part of the leg, and he never missed a booking or anything. And thanks to some dollars in the right place, we kept that off TV and out of the newspaper. But I never had any issues with Slater. He worked, like I say, he worked hard, and I've seen some pictures of him when he had to get the wrestling get together here in Atlanta a couple years ago, the Greg Price thing. I saw some pictures, and somebody had to tell me who it was because I didn't recognize him.
What happened to him?
He was in a wheelchair.
I know, but what happened to him?
I heard he messed his back up. Well, I also he did some jail time in Florida. He had some issues with a girlfriend down there on several occasions. But I think just there again, too many crazy bumps and too many medications and different things. I really don't know. I know when he first came in here, he had a Corvette that Floyd Briscoe, Jack and Jerry's brother that run the garage there in Tampa, had built the engine in it for him. And the dang thing, it was an airplane. I mean, that thing, if it had wings, it would have left the ground. And come back from Savannah one night, and Jerry, you made that trip many times. You can remember how I-16 was back then. There wasn't nothing on it. I mean, it was just dark. And I was in my car, but Randy, my buddy Randy, was driving, and I was actually propped up against the window on the other side of sleep, and I felt the car wobble. So I set up, and when I set up, all I saw was a set of tail lights. And Randy just said one word. He said Slater, and I said okay. So I put my head back against the window, and what seemed like maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes, I felt the car wobble again, and I raised up and I looked, and there was another set of taillights. And Randy looked at me and said, State Patrol chasing Slater. I went, okay.
I remember that.
Oh, geez. They said, and here, this is, you know, the story I was told. When we used to come home from Columbus on Wednesday nights, we had to run old 85. This is before 185, and it was two-lane road. Other than that little stretch coming toward Waverly Hall out of Columbus, it was two lane the whole way to Atlanta.
Exactly.
And the little old city cop in Sanoa, Georgia, used to sit and wait on us. And he would, once a week, he'd get somebody and pull, and even if he didn't write him a ticket, he'd just pull them over so he could talk to them. And Slater and Orton were in that Corvette. And they pulled Slater over, and Slater put two wheels on the dirt and left two on the pavement. And this guy got out of the car and started up toward the car. And when he got right up toward the back of Slater's car, they said Slater stomped that Corvette and threw dirt and gravel and rocks and just took off up the road. They say Slater went from Sanoa, Georgia, and that's from Sanoa to Fayetteville is 13 miles, and from Fayetteville to the Villa Rouge apartments where they lived was probably another, I don't know, 12 miles, so about 25 miles, I'm guessing. They said Slater went from Sanoa to Villa Rouge apartments in 13 minutes. They said Orton Jr. had a beer in his hand, and they said that the beer, he squeezed the can. He never took a sip, and they said that he couldn't talk. So, just whether fact or rumor, I guess it's up to history, but I've always heard it was the truth.
I don't doubt it. All right, next name on our list, I don't know if either one of you, Bobby, you were probably around him because you were working in the office when he was a rookie. Jerry, I don't know if you ever crossed paths with him or not. Terry Taylor.
I knew Terry, worked with Terry, but it was later on, after he was a Red Rooster.
Oh.
That was a heck of a gimmick. I know
they
he appreciates
him.
Whoever thought that up.
Okay.
They killed him.
God.
And he was a great worker, too, but he was just not the type of worker that Vince wanted. He could actually wrestle. And that's why you ever notice that anybody that was over in any other territory, they brought him up to New York and just killed him. And this is getting away
like
from talking
about Dusty being the pizza man.
Yeah, Dusty being the pizza man. But the worst case of it that I ever saw, and this is getting away from Terry a little bit, was Junkyard Dog. They took somebody that was the Louisiana version of Dusty Rhodes. He was so over there, and so many people believed in him, and he was, you know, they sold him. Watch sold him as just, you know, he wasn't the greatest wrestler in the world, but he was just double tough big person that you just couldn't hurt. And Vince gets him up there, and next thing you know, he's dancing to Grab Them Cakes.
I think that was his way of just showing you wasn't nothing.
That's exactly right. He wanted to break you.
Yeah. I know he paid guys a heck of a lot of money to do that, and that was the name of the game, so the guys went along with it. But just, you know, like with Terry, it just run what they were about. But Terry was one of those guys when I was coming over doing television jobs. He was one of those guys that, you know,
he'd get a win every once in a while on TV, but for the most part, you know, he was just one step above the job guys, guys like him and Steve-O and guys like that, but was a tremendous worker and turned out to have a good head for the business and was a good booker everywhere he worked.
He did later on, but he was very naive when he first started. He was very, and he would believe, you could tell him anything and he'd believe it. My wife was selling tickets one night in the town, and he came up front where she was, and he asked her, he said, "How much money you make a night?" And Debbie looked at him, knowing that the guarantee was $65, I think, at the time, or $55, whatever it was. It was $50. And she told him, she says, he told her, he said, "Well, I see you a lot. You travel around doing this." And she goes, "Yeah, I work for the office." He said, "Well, how much do they pay you?" And she told him, I make $60 a night. And he went, "By God, the ticket seller makes more than I do." And he stomped off to the dressing room. So, you know, it was just.
Where'd he wind up? Last I heard, he was with TNA. That's the last I heard of him.
Well, he was a road agent for them. And he let him go, and I think that's where he wound up, wasn't it, Michael?
Yeah. Well, he's not with either. I don't even think he's in the business anymore.
Yeah. He was, his wife died from cancer last year, before.
Last year before, something like that.
And Scott Till and his wife, they go to the same church. It's a big, huge church. And Scott said he didn't even know that they went to the same church.
Well, I didn't know Terry had moved to Tennessee. Last I ran into him about a year before I left Atlanta, so about 7 years ago, 7-8 years ago, at a Kroger over off of where was it? Sugarloaf, and he must have he lived around that area at that time because we stopped and talked for a few minutes or so, and. He was working for TNA then, but he was still living in Metro Atlanta at that time.
Well, he was. Scott said that they were the funeral for his wife was at the church he belongs to, and he said evidently that he didn't even know they'd never run into each other.
Wow,
that's something.
Wow. All right, another name. There again, I don't know if either one of you guys ever worked with this gentleman. Jerry, you may have late in his career. Bobby, I don't know when the last time he worked in Georgia, but Danny Little Bear.
Oh, my God.
Danny was here in 70. Danny was here in 76, 77, too.
He was in Mobile
in
76.
I was in Kansas City around Little Bear. Man, let me tell you.
That's right. You two were tag team partners, weren't you? You were Central States tag team champions at one time, aren't you? Good thing you weren't. You were on his team. He was stiff as a board. I know that.
That was the weirdest man I've ever been around. That's all I can say.
You know, Danny married a lady from Jonesboro. He was living here when he passed away, and of course, Mary comes to our reunion in Mobile every year. But yeah, Danny was one of those people. In our business, everybody knew somebody that could get you whatever you wanted, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. If you needed a car, your car worked on, somebody knew somebody. I remember when I first came over to the Georgia office, I needed some work done on my car, and Roger Kirby says, "I got a guy right down here in Mara," and the guy repaired it, so I met this guy through Roger Kirby. But I made the comment one night I needed a set of tires. And Danny said, well, what do you want? And I said, "Well, I just want some steel-belted radios." I said, "I'm not looking for Michelins, but if I get a good deal, I really don't know. I haven't looked yet." So the next day I'm at the office, up drives Danny in his van. He motions for me to come out the door, and I walked out there, and he opens the back door of his van, and there were six complete sets of tires in the back of his van. And he said, "These are Michelins, these are Coopers, these are Daytons, these are this." He said, "Which one you want?" I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "How much are we talking?" He said, $100 a set. Just pick out which set you want." I said, "Well, I'll take these Coopers." So I don't.
And where he got those tires?
I didn't ask. Didn't want to know. You know, and I bet you ran into this too, Jerry. Fans would come up to you, and they would say, "Hey, you interested in such and such?"
And, oh yeah.
You know, you'd go, "Well, when video recorders first came out, I had Barnett suggested that I purchase a video recorder. Matter of fact, he strongly suggested I purchase a video recorder. He said, if you're not going to watch the show on Saturday night, you need to record it where you can go back and watch it and make sure all the spots air properly and blah, blah, blah." I bought a RCA VBT200, and this is burned into my mind because I paid $1,000 for it.
Oh, my God.
Heavy as a boat anchor, and it would record. You could set it for up to 24 hours ahead, and it would record for 4 hours. But you couldn't. It recorded only on the channel you set it on. It wouldn't, you know. I mean, now for $30, you buy something, it'll switch channels and do whatever. But I had a fan come up to the window there at the arena one day, and he goes, "You know anybody?" Well, to back up my story, when I bought that, it came with a videotape, and I told the guy at the store, I said, "Well, I may want a couple of extra tapes." And he goes, "Well," he said, "I'll be glad to sell them to you." He said, "But they're $39 a piece, $39.99. I mean, a videotape was $40. Now, you got to remember, this is when it first came out. So I said, "No, I'll just deal with the one in the pack for the time being." So anyway, not much time goes by, and this guy comes up to the window, and he goes, you interested in buying some videotapes?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "What you got?" He said, "I'll sell them to you for $20 a case." And I said, "How many is in a case?" He said, 10. I said, "How many can you get?" He said, "As many as you want." I said, "Bring me 5 cases of them." So he brought me 5 sealed in the carton, 10 tapes in a case, Fuji's, which was a pretty good brand of videotape. I mean, you know, people just, I mean, anything. And it, yeah, strange
don't
stuff.
Don't you just
too.
Miss all that stuff?
I do miss it. I do. Scrappy McGowan one time, he come in the office and said, "You know anybody wants to buy some nuts?" And I said, "What kind of nuts?" And he says, "Cashews." And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "What you got?" He says, "I got a guy that can get cashews, and he'll sell them to us for $20 a case." And I said, "How many cans in a case?" He said, 24, I think. I said, "I want 5 cases of them." Now, I love cashews. I'm addicted. I'm sorry. My name is Bobby, and I'm a cashew junkie. But they're like $6 a can in the grocery store, you know.
I know they're expensive.
Listen, Mr. McGowan's buddy delivers 5 cases of Fisher cashews, the whole cashews, 24 cans in a box, in a case, and delivered me 5 cases for $100.
Are you talking about that on them?
Do what?
I miss them.
I miss those kind of deals.
I thought about that story the other day, Bobby. I went in the Publix around the corner from me to pick up some stuff, and just as you go in the door, sitting on a shelf there, they have boiled peanuts in what must be a gallon or gallon and a half can. It looks like a 55-gallon drum sitting there, these boiled peanuts. I'm thinking, who in the world? Because once you open it, they didn't have the little plastic lid on them like you could seal them back up. Once you open them, you had to eat every peanut in there. I'm thinking, it would take somebody 8 hours to go through these peanuts, and they'd be so sick by the time they got through them.
Well, see, it's
they ended up throwing half of them away.
So you're in that college town down there where Valdez State, and according to Jerry Clower, it's good Southern etiquette to have a peanut boiling when your kid comes home from college.
I guess. Oh man, what a job! I was thinking something when you were talking about that. It's totally slipped my mind about people getting you stuff. Oh, I know what it was. You mentioned that
recorder. Was it a beta or a VCR?
No, it was VHS.
Now, we all know and love Ted Allen. Ted Allen was the first person I ever saw with a VHS, and he had hundreds of tapes from every wrestling territory you can think of. Now, for lack of a better term, we all know how frugal Ted was. You don't think he paid $1,000 for that?
Oh, jeez. Listen, he came up one time. He called me, and this is when I was working in the office for Barnett, and he calls me, and he goes, Bobby, he says, I've come into the possession of a video camera and a 3/4-inch cassette deck that's hooked to it. He said, you record directly on the the 3/4-inch tape. He said, I'll take $750 for it if the office is interested in buying it. Well, he come down there, and, I mean, this thing is strapped to a hand truck. And you roll it around on a little hand truck and camera, you know, it had a wire. Well, I told Barnett about it, and Barnett said, well, can we use it? I said, I don't know. I've seen it, and I've seen it, it'll tape. I said, but, you know, 3/4-inch tape was kind of new. The cassette version was kind of new to the TV industry. So I said, what we need to do is, I said, we need to tape something and take it over to 17 and see what kind of quality it is and if it's something that's airworthy. And, of course, when we got over there, it wasn't anywhere near what their standard was, so we didn't buy it. But, I mean, he would come up with more stuff. The funniest thing Ted ever did to me, Mary Bunch, who Jerry will know who I'm talking about, when she passed away, her daughter got in touch with me and wanted to know if I wanted all of her old wrestling magazines and pictures and stuff. And they had stored it in a little outside shed, and, of course, a lot of it was ruined where it got, you know, the water had gotten to it, and it was just, there was a lot of stuff there that couldn't be salvaged. But I probably wound up with 2 boxes of wrestling magazines. Well, I didn't want them, and I wasn't going to go through them. I mean, it was just, you know, I kind of scanned them to see if there was anything from Georgia that I might want. But I called Ted, and I went, Ted, I said, I got all these books. If you'll come down here and get them, I'll give them to you. So he drove from Cartersville to my house, and I helped him load them in his car, and off he went. We got to Mobile that year, and I kept seeing people go in and out of Ted's room, so I walked down there to see what was going. When I got down there, laying on the bed is all these wrestling magazines that I had given him, and he had went through them. And he, of course, you know, he never had a real job, so he had plenty of time. He went through all of these things, and he took these little post-it note things, and he stuck them on pages with people that was at the reunion and wrote their name on it. And he was bringing them in there, and he was showing them, you're in this one, you're in this one, you're in, and he was selling them for $5 a piece. I told him, I said, hey.
That was him.
I said, man, I said, am I in for a cut of this? He said, why? You gave them to me. And I said, okay. But that was Ted.
Well, there's a coda to that story that you may not know. He got me. I had five or six old Southeastern posters from when Fuller first started running in Mobile. I had acquired them somewhere. Well, he wanted them. So he offered me a trade. I think he traded me a dozen magazines for those five posters. And they were, of course, they weren't the ones that were good. They were all the ones that the covers had been gotten wet and torn off and all this.
Oh, yeah. Jeez.
Oh, man. Oh, boy, Ted. He was one of a kind, I think. All right. Well, moving right along. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say I miss him. He was so funny. He was. I used to kid him. I said, "You make Joe Scarpa look like a big spender."
Well, moving along on our list, the next name, Oki Shekina, or Pedro Zapata, or Tony Jimenez, which is what his real name was. I think he was best known as Oki Shekina.
Well, I got an Oki Shekina story. He was in Kansas City when we were out there. So, he and I ran up on this guy at the Buick dealership. He put you in a car, right? You know, so Ted and I bought several cars from him. And okay, he goes, we tell all the boys where to go. It was, I forget the name of the Buick dealership. Anyhow, Oki goes down there and gets him a Cadillac. Somehow or another, Oki never paid for the car. So he leaves Kansas City. I think he comes back to Georgia. And I forgot how that went down. I don't know if they come got the car, but this was years later. He never paid for that car. I thought I was getting a deal. I left that to Ted about it. He probably remembers better about that than I did. But we know he never paid for it. I don't know if they come got it or was going to come get it. And he had worn it out. Don't you lose his legs?
Yeah, he lost both of them.
Yeah.
I heard.
Last time I saw him, he rode a Greyhound bus from what, Houston or Dallas? Dallas, I think, to Mobile, Alabama, to come to the reunion. I got some pictures around here somewhere with him, and then he.
I thought he lived in like Valdosta.
He lived in Tejera. Had a lawnmower shop there for years, and. But for some reason he'd been in Texas, and then when he come to the reunion, then Levi Banks gave him a ride from Mobile back to Hayhira. He took him back over and dropped him off.
He was visiting his brother in Houston.
Is that what it was?
It was Houston. Yeah, because his brother came the next year, which was my first year at the reunion, and I sat and talked to his brother forever. His brother was big buddies with Bull Ramos. And lived in Houston, and that's where Oki was at. He was had been out there to visit his brother, and then, in fact, his brother may have been with him when he came to Mobile, and then he went back to Houston, and Oki rode back with Levi.
Yeah.
Georgia. But
remember the first TV we did for Ann Jerry when, or was it might have been the second one. When Oki came over there and y'all got him out there to do an interview, and we couldn't get him to shut up.
Yeah.
She just kept on and on and on. I was in the control room. I was fixing to come out and take up a collection. I thought he was whipping them into submission. Oh, what a
Oki
funny guy.
Well, maybe he thought out there in Kansas City that Geigel had run one of those Buddy Fuller Cadillac tournaments and he'd won that car.
Oh, jeez.
Evidently, that's what happened.
You know, now, speaking of cars, isn't it funny how, now you said this guy here in Kansas City you met out there, okay. You know, in Georgia, Soto traded with Meadows Motors there in Manchester.
Forever.
He would come to Georgia and trade cars. I mean, that's where he always traded cars. There was a dealership in Atlanta, an Oldsmobile dealership, Lewis Welch Oldsmobile. I bet they sold 1,000 cars to wrestlers.
Is that
Lewis Welch Senior, the guy
worked?
That do what?
Where did Bill Bowman work that sold cars?
Bill worked for Bob Maddox Chrysler Plymouth.
Okay.
Out on Forest Parkway. But Renesto one time called Lewis Welch and told him he was with the NAACP and he was trying to solicit donations. And Lewis Welch put this poor mouth on him about, well, we just ain't sold many cars, we ain't done this, we ain't done that, and just ain't been a lot of money, and you know how the economy is. And Renesto let him talk for about 5 minutes. Renesto said, well, I know you ain't nothing but a liar now because you made $1 million off him wrestlers and hung up on him.
I hate I never got to be around him. All the stories you guys have told and other people have told.
Oh,
and being
man,
around his
please.
Son is probably pretty close, and I've been around his son plenty, but Tom Jr. doesn't have quite the gift of gab that this senior did.
There was nobody like Tom. He was in a class all by himself.
Renesto could talk Ray Candy into an ambulance. He'd walk up to him. He'd walk up to me and go, "Brother, you okay? You don't look good tonight. Your skin color's not real good. You feel okay? Sit down right here. How's your blood pressure?"
He'd be serious too, Bobby.
Oh yeah. Oh, he was funny.
All right, the next name on our list, Tim Woods.
Tim Woods. I saw him get his finger bit off.
You were there that night?
I was there.
That was what, 68?
Yeah, I was sitting in front row. Yep. Ooh. Wrong guy at the wrong time.
Yeah.
Tim was too nice. Too nice.
He
I never
was
worked with
that
Tim
guy
was.
After that happened, though, didn't he?
Do what now?
Didn't he end up hooking that guy somehow or another and making him give up after he bit his finger off?
Arnold Sperlin bit his finger off and rolled out of the ring. He had done his damage.
Okay.
And Tim bailed out of the ring right behind him. Oh, it was a mess. Oh, man. Everybody in Columbus, Georgia was down there. They were standing all the way to the back wall, Bobby. They were standing. But everybody in town knew Arnold Sperlin, you know. But I never worked with Tim. Ted said he worked with him. He said it was an absolute nightmare.
Tim was clumsy.
That's what Ted said. He said he'd step on your hands. And
he was clumsy.
But let
nice
me tell you
guy.
Something. He was
nice
over.
Guy, but buddy, he was clumsy.
Was
I mean, refereeing, you'd get beat to death.
He was over when he was here the first time. Oh, yes. My gosh.
Yes, sir.
He was some kind of over.
That was a Leo Garibaldi creation.
Yep.
They ran his
picture
in the Atlanta program for 3 months before he got here. Never had been a baby face with a mask on, and they would show these pictures of him, just white boots, white mask, white trunks, just him by himself. I mean, it was just Mr. Wrestling coming, and when he was over before he got here.
Exactly.
And when he got here, man, he was just something else.
And Tim had a heck of a body on him too.
Yep. Yep.
He was a big man.
Yep. El Mongo was the top heel here when he got here, and what matches they had. Timmy did a small package, man. Now did you ever see him do the small package where he stood on his head?
Where he stood
head?
On his head, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Only person I ever seen do it. He, I'll never forget, and here again, this is a Garibaldi finish. They had a match one night in Atlanta, and here again, I'm a kid, you know, watching the matches, and I didn't know what was going on. But him against El Mongo. Mongo was the Georgia State champion. It's for the title. If he loses, he's got to unmask. And they worked the deal where El Mongo took the mask and twisted it, where he blinded him. You know, he couldn't see, you know, quote-unquote, through the mask. And he was swinging wildly, and Mongo was just chopping at will. And, you know, this went on for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, you know. I mean, Timmy couldn't get the mask straightened out. Every time he'd go straighten it out, Mongo would chop him or get him or whatever. The finish to the match was Timmy reached up and snatched the mask off his head. But as soon as he snatched the mask off, he grabbed Mongo and he rolled him up in that thing where he's standing on his head and his face is hid. 1, 2, 3, and as soon as the match is over, somebody from the stage is there with a towel, and they got it over Timmy's head, and boom, off he goes. And just to show you how good this is, I may be the only human being in the world, but I can remember these things because they were so good, and they were such an important part of my life. I remember Dandy Jack on TV the next day, the interview he did. He said, you know, because Mongol supposedly couldn't speak English. He said, Mongo was taken advantage of. He thought the match was over. He took the mask off. He thought it was over. He relaxed. So then you got the perfect set up to, for a return match the next week.
Mm. Now, playing into what the guy biting his finger off in Columbus, Bobby, you told this before. I don't know if you've told it on air, but he had a match with Gene Kaniski for the world title.
Friday night after that happened, Wednesday night.
Right. And how that ended, what the finish was on that, was so simple. There again, Garibaldi and his thinking and was so simple that he conceded to Kaniski basically working on his finger.
Well, yeah. you gotta understand now, when that thing happened in Columbus on Wednesday night, there was a huge article in the Atlanta newspaper the next day, or it may have ran Friday afternoon or Friday morning. It was Thursday morning or Friday morning. There's an article in the Atlanta paper about that happening in Columbus, and it had a picture of Tim Wood's hand where his finger had been off. So the people in Atlanta knew the finger was bit off. They knew it wasn't, you know, everybody knew what had happened. And my uncle and his girlfriend were sitting in the first balcony, and, of course, I was a kid. I had to have ringside, and I managed to get a second-row seat. And I watched that match from the second row in Atlanta, and I mean, you know, he just ate Kaniski up for about 40 minutes, and then Kaniski went after that finger. And Timmy never gave up. Garibaldi stopped the match. Took the heat for stopping the match. So your top babyface was still intact. The champion left with the belt. And
set up for a return match at some point down the line. That's just ABC booking.
Jeez. That was the name of the company back then.
Yeah.
That was the name of the ABC booking.
You know what, I probably told you guys, that was when that was originally thought up, it was going to be Atlanta, Birmingham, and Charlotte.
Chattanooga.
It was supposed to be Ray Gunkel. Was it Chattanooga? I thought it was Charlotte.
Chattanooga.
Okay, so it was supposed to be Gunkel and Gulas. I thought Crockett was supposed to be in that deal. But it never worked out that way.
Atlanta, Birmingham, Chattanooga. That was original. That was the name of the reason, the way they came up with the name.
Well, they ended up getting Chattanooga many years later, but they never worked in Birmingham.
No.
All right, the final name on our list. And there again, I never got to spend any time with him. I don't know if you, Bobby, I know you did a little bit. Jerry, I don't know if you ever did or not. Andre the Giant.
Yes, I did. Yep. He traveled with me quite a few times. There was a, you know, he was always very kind to me, very, very nice, very appreciative for hauling him. A lot of guys didn't want to haul him, you know, I didn't care. And you know, I really felt sorry for him. He was, everything was miserable for him, you know. You can just imagine.
Yeah.
But
the only time he seemed happy was when he was in the ring or in the dressing room or in an environment where it was just the boys.
He spent a lot of time by himself, you know.
Yep.
You know, guys didn't hang out with the Giant, you know. They just – but the life he lived, I wouldn't have wanted to have lived it. Of course,
yeah,
I'm sure he didn't either.
Do you think he knew how big an attraction he was?
He had to have known.
Oh, yeah.
He had to. I mean, he wasn't a cocky guy or arrogant guy or anything like that. You know, he was...
Thank God he wasn't, because you imagine if he wanted to grab you?
Oh, my God. Yeah, what would you do?
No, whatever he wanted.
Whatever he wanted. But he was, you know, that would have had to have been a sad life.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, everything you wore had to be made. And what it cost to feed him, then later on what he spent drinking,
I would imagine the travel itself would have been miserable, because he couldn't fit on an airplane, he didn't fit in most cars.
Well, he had to buy two seats on the airplane.
Yeah.
And he flew first class everywhere he went. He didn't have any choice, you know. When I first met him, he could not speak very good English when I first met him in 74. And Frank Valois was his...
I was going to say Frank Valois was
his manager, agent, whatever they wanted to call him. It's who Vern, you know, Vince Sr. was paying Valois to travel with him.
Right.
And the deal was the Giant was supposed to get a percentage just like the champion was. And, it, of course, didn't always work out that way. But he was supposed to get a percentage just like the champion. But he would... I mean, you were very limited in what you could do with him. I mean, you had... If you put him in the ring against your biggest heel, and I don't care who it was, Stan Hansen, Abdullah the Butcher, they dwarfed compared to him. Because when I first met him, you know, 74, 75, 76, he 7'5", almost 500 pounds was not an exaggeration. That's how big he was. As years went on, he began to shrink because his knees began to bow. His legs bowed out on him a little because of the weight. And he got shorter, and he got bigger and thicker. But, I mean, when I first met him, he could hold his hand in front of my face, and I couldn't see around it without moving my head. And he was just, if he had ever got mad or he had ever really went after somebody, I mean, just, you couldn't have done nothing with him. Just the sheer size,
no,
you couldn't have done nothing with him. But he was Jerry hit it right on it. He was gentle. He was kind to a fault. He just, I guess like you said about Bubba, he played the game. He knew what his role was, and that's what he did. But I like you, Jerry. I always got the feeling he was a very sad individual because he just.
Down deep, Bubby, you could just.
Yeah.
See, you know, a lot of guys probably didn't see it because they didn't care. But I just, the first time I met him was in 1973 in Houston, Texas. Now, he was big then, but God, I'd see him like a year later and another year later, and I thought, my God, he's gotten bigger.
Yeah.
You know, every year he was bigger, bigger. You know, it was just, when he was in 73, he was big, but nothing like you. Later became, you know. And Valois, he wasn't a friendly fellow.
No. I don't think Valois wanted to be doing what he was doing, but.
You know, that may be it, too.
Yeah.
That may be it, too.
Well, usually, I know every time Andre would come to the Mobile territory, Valois was with him. He'd work the opening match, and he'd do a job. And, you know, he had to have been pushing 60 then, you know,
exactly.
Be out there, you know, doing jobs and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm sure depending on what promoter that he was working for, they insisted he work as well. If they were going to, he was getting paid to do whatever he was doing. But I think Vince paid him. But I'd always heard about Andre.
Right.
That he didn't expect to live much beyond 30. And I'm sure a lot of that weighed on his mind, too, is, you know, he's sure he was making a ton of money and everything, but then, you know, you're going to die at 30, what do you do? I think that's why he started with the drinking and the overeating and all that stuff, because he figured he was going to die anyway. He might as well live his life and live happy. But
well, at least he bought that place in North Carolina. You know, at least he bought him a place where he could call home. He could go home, and he had some horses, and, you know, he could at least have a place that was his that he could, you know, when he wasn't on the road, he could go and hide out and just be himself. And he had his furniture specially built so that he was comfortable there. And then, of course, he hooked up with Frenchie Bernard and moved Frenchie in to him and his wife to take care of the place when he wasn't there. And then when he died, he left it to Frenchie.
Right.
So they had a place. And I'm assuming his wife is there now. I know Frenchie died, a month ago or so now, I guess.
Yeah.
So.
A lot of people don't realize that, you know, most people had never heard of Andre until the 70s. But he had started working in Europe in the mid-60s and was a big star in France and England and especially Japan long before he ever came to the States. Eduardo Carpentier is the one that brought him over to North America, and he worked up there for the Vachons in their Grand Prix territory before he got signed with Vince. He worked for them, and then Vachons were close to Vern, so Vern started using him, and that's probably how you saw him in Texas, because Vern was close to Paul Bosch, so he got down in Texas, and with Fritz, so he got down in Texas that early, and then somewhere along the line, he signed the deal with Vince Sr. to be his exclusive booking agent, so everybody had to go through him. And he first came to the United, or the North America, he worked under the name Jean Ferret, which means, hey, you or good friend or something, John Friend or something like that. And then in Japan, he was Monster Rusumov. He was a heel. And, of course, that was a natural rivalry between he and Baba. I don't think he ever expected to get the career that he ended up having. And I think, you know, he was beholden to the McMahons is the reason he worked, you know, nearly to his deathbed, because he was in bad shape the last few years he worked. And
yeah,
he was still an attraction, but you can imagine the pain he had to have been in just walking out to the ring, especially with his knees, like Bobby said, his knees as bad as they were.
Yeah.
But that was where he was happy, was in the ring and, you know, being around the boys. I can imagine that's why he continued to do it. But
I'm not a drinker. I never was. But we would we used to pay this guy a little bit of cash to let us hang out in the bar in Columbus, Ohio, after the shows on Sunday night, because our plane didn't leave before something in the morning. And I would sit in the back and work on payroll, because payday was Monday, and trying to get it done where I didn't have such a hectic day when I got back to Atlanta, because it was just, I was up all night and then up all day Monday. But some of the best times I ever remember with Andre was just watching him. He would come in that bar with all the guys, and the doors are closed, and of course there's nobody in there but us and the bartender, and you know, they're paying for the drinks, but before long Andre would be behind the bar, and he'd have the bartender sitting up on the bar, and he would be mixing the drinks. And it was just, that was his thing. He was with the boys, he seemed happy, and you know, as corny as it sounds, it made me happy to sit back and watch him, because I just felt like, I'm kind of like Jerry, I just felt like his existence was miserable other than just the times he could do stuff like this.
You know, we tease Jerry a lot about the McGuire twins, but all those type wrestlers, the McGuire twins, Haystacks, Man Mountain Mike, you know, all those guys, it had to have been hard on them. And I guess it was kind of like working for a carnival or of the circus or something. Where else could those guys make a living, you know?
That's what you say. You know, we laugh about the McGuires. The McGuires got sucked into a business because some promoter said, I can make some money with these guys. And I'm using the term freak in a loose sense of the word, but that's what they were to these promoters. We've got an attraction here. We throw them on the card once a year, ride their little mini bikes or whatever they do. People will pay to come see them. And, you know, that was Andre, I don't put in the same category, but poor Haystacks. Haystacks traveled by himself 99% of the time, him and his dog. He always drove an International Harvester. And wasn't that what it was, Jerry? An International Harvester? Was it? Have I got the right thing?
International Travel Law. It's a Travel Law International.
Yeah, International, yeah. And he would, but he had him and his dog. And, I mean, he was by himself other than the dog 99% of the times. And I used to love to sit and talk to him. What a funny, great fella he was.
Yeah, I made a lot of miles with him.
Yeah. Nice guy.
He was. I like Stacks. I really did.
I did too.
I really did.
Well,
yeah,
Chris Taylor's another example, Michael.
Yeah,
you know, he won that medal in the Olympics, and Vern trained him, and they stuck him in. They sent him here for 2 weeks. He rode with me for 2 weeks. You know, again, like Jerry says, guys didn't want to haul him. He's a big fella. Well, he climbed right in my little Dodge, and off we went. And nice guy, good kid. But just there again, people, what could you do with him? I mean, there was nothing that you were going to be. You couldn't work a long-term program with him. He was just, you bring him in for 2 weeks and stick him with middle-of-the-road guys that he can beat every night, and that's pretty much all you could do.
That's true. That's true. You could never use guys like that long-term in any territory. I guess New York was the longest Haystacks ever worked.
Yeah.
In one place, you know. Because I know how they were all used in Mobile. Andre would I don't think he ever came in as a special tag team partner. He just came in and did battle royals for handicap matches.
You mentioned Brody and Ernie Ladd earlier. Ernie Ladd, you could take and put in a program and run him as long as you want, do whatever you wanted with Ladd. But Brody, what could you do with Brody? Everybody, I mean, and I hate the guy got killed, but it's sort of, they've made a saint out of him. But you look at his matches and there's no way you could have put that guy you couldn't have plugged him into a spot in Georgia and ran a 6-8 month program with him.
There's no way.
No.
After 2 weeks, you've seen it.
Yeah, kick, you know, I mean, that was it.
Lick your hand and bark.
Jeez.
Yeah, I think Fritz got more out of him than anybody else. I know, you know, but St. Louis used him, but they only ran, once a month in St. Louis? Once every 2 weeks, something like that. He was a big star there.
Yeah, that wasn't a regular thing. That wasn't a regular deal there.
But, I don't know. There were quite a few guys in the business that got their spots because of their looks and everything, and then they just, you know, unless they went to work for Vince, what could you do with them? Hogan was an example. They couldn't do anything with him in Georgia. Fuller used him for a few months, but he was no great shakes. Once you'd seen him, you'd seen him. You know?
Well, guys, this has been an interesting show tonight.
Yeah, we may do this again next week. I may come up with 10, 12 more names next week.
That sounds good.
We are out of time tonight, so as always, I appreciate it. Dear, won't you just bypass the beach on your little scooter and come on down here and have lunch with me one day at Valdosta?
I don't see nothing wrong with that. I might come down there on that view myself. I might just ride the whole thing down there.
We'll go find us some boiled peanuts. I know we can get a gallon can of them.
Well, me and you can finish a gallon of them off, I promise you. We'll save Bobby a few.
Well, guys, it's been great.
Bobby, thank you for the picture, sir.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. I'm glad you liked it.
I really appreciate that.
Well, you guys have a good week, and we'll get together next Thursday and do this again.
Sounds good, guys. Y'all have a great week.
Good night, guys.
All right. Good night.
I'm done, honey.
We thank you for listening to The Tripod, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.